At 11 o'clock that night, about 3 miles from the canyon where the Thunder Riders had holed up, Marshal Patchen filled his coffee cup from a speckled tin pot and sank back against his saddle. He glanced over at Sheriff Spears, who sat on a rock about 6 feet from the low cook fire, hunkered deep in his wool coat and staring out at the darkness while smoking a Quirly and sipping from his own steaming coffee cup. Patchen could tell that the sheriff was mentally licking his wounds. Spears had been made a fool of by the Thunder Riders, then saved by a man he'd thrown in jail. Knowing now that he shouldn't have jailed the breed in the first place, obviously Yakima Henry wasn't one of the gang members, was even more embarrassing. Patchen absently fingered a raw buzzard peck on his right cheek. Of course, he was as much a fool as Spears, but Patchen had been a fool before, so he didn't take it as hard. And he would be a fool again. No man, especially a lawman, could expect not to be a fool now and again on this savage frontier. The trick was to learn from your foolishness and continue living in spite of it. Patchen crossed his boots and hunkered down inside his Mackinaw, resting his coffee cup on his thigh.
Tell me, Spears, why are you still so determined to take down this gang? Your nose is broken, your posse's been wiped out, you've been buried up to your neck in sand, nearly had your eyes pecked out, and you're over 100 miles south of the border. Can't just be the gold you're after, or the girl.
I used to ride with that kill-crazy bastard.
Considine.
Several years ago, when I was a kid, you fed me to a catch party for a joke. Bastard strung me up, left me hanging, damn near killed me. But I worked myself free, gave up the Owlhoo Trail, excepting a couple times, and vowed that if I ever had the chance, I'd kill that murdering four-flusher.
Instead, he got the gold you were guarding, shot up your town, and nabbed your girl.
Spears turned a hard look on Patchen, holding the cigarette between the thumb and index finger of his right hand.
Oh, I'm glad you think it's so funny. What about you? You're just as far from your jurisdiction as I am mine.
The smile faded from the marshal's face as he stared into his coffee, absently swirling it.
Now I can tell you a better Considine story than that. About a year ago, he hit the town I was living in, shot up a saloon, and kidnapped my daughter. Took her off the street in front of the haberdashery. I tracked him into the mountains above Tucson. Found Peg's naked body in the Salt River Canyon. She'd been beaten, carved up.
Patchen's eyes hardened as he stared out over the rim.
Before he hit Saber Creek, he shot a pair of rangers, execution style. That's what I'm gonna do to him.
Spears sucked on his Quirly as he looked off through the desert willows.
Not if I get him.
He stopped, frowning, slowly reaching up to pluck the Quirly from between his lips.
What is it?
Spears threw out an arm as he continued staring through the darkness.
Quick, douse the fire.
Patchen threw out the last of his coffee and sprang to his feet, kicking dirt on a fire. A second later, he was crouched beside Spears, his Henry in his hands, following the sheriff's gaze through the willows and across the rolling rocky slopes, cloaked in starlit darkness. It was hard to judge distance in this broken country, but about a mile away, a flickering cone-shaped light shone. As Spears and Patchen stared, another, smaller light grew left of the first. A minute later, still another light appeared, quickly gaining vibrancy until it was as bright as the first two. The three fires were about 10-15 yards apart. The lawmen glanced at each other.
What do you think?
I think we got company.
Strange time to be setting up camp.
Ain't it, though?
Patchen rubbed his sunburned chin.
Think we ought to check it out?
It smells like a trap.
If it's a gang, we might be able to pop a couple and get Aunt Jeanette out before they do to her what they did to your girl.
If they haven't already.
When she's safe, we can go back in for Considine and the gold.
On the other hand, we might be wandering into an Indian camp or banditos.
Spears smirked.
Well, how in hell are we gonna know if we don't check it out?
I reckon you have a point.
Patchen walked back to the doused fire where smoke rose from the dusty ashes and began gathering his gear.
We best break camp in case we need to split ass out of here.
Both men rolled their blankets and saddled up.
Let's take it slow. Apache slow. They could be waiting for us between here and the fires.
Spears towed his stirrup while holding his saddle horn.
You know, Patchen, you ain't the only experienced lawman out here.
Patchen turned his horse and gigged it around rocks and through the willows, heading toward the fires.
Maybe not, but at least I learned from my experiences.
Spears gigged his own mount up beside Patchen's.
I heard that. You're talking about that damn ambush, ain't you? Well, goddammit, I done told you I was sorry about that. Those sons of bitches are slick as damn snakes in the privet pit.
Don't be sorry. Just keep your mouth shut, your eyes open.
Patchen swung his head from left to right as he walked the horse down a rocky hill, starlight limning the sage, creosote, and occasional pine.
You keep your mouth shut.
Spears reined his horse a few yards right of the marshal and raked his gaze across the brush and the low rolling hills revealed by starlight. Moving slowly, the lawmen worked their way to within 100 yards of the fires. They dismounted, tied their horses to a couple of low pines in a crease between hogbacks, and continued on foot, about 10 yards apart and holding their rifles up high across their chests. They stepped quietly, keeping a low boulder snag between them and the fires, stopping every few yards to look around, listen. As they moved closer to the fires, they could see sparks rising above the rocks, winking out among the low cottonwood branches. Spears moved around left of the rubble while Patchen slipped to the right. The marshal hunkered down behind a boulder and peered toward the flickering firelight about 30 yards ahead. The three fires burned in shallow pits. The wood had burned down some, but the flames still reached several feet into the air. Around them, no one. There was no tack or gear of any kind, no extra wood for keeping the fires burning. It was as if someone had merely set the fires and left. Electricity fired through Patchen's veins. His first instinct had been correct.
Shit, fires are a trap.
He began to retreat when the snap of a branch rose on the other side of the false encampment. He stopped, held his position, and peered around the rocks. In the brush beyond the firelight, a shadow moved. Flames winked off steel. A rifle.
It's trapped.
Two figures materialized from the shadows on the other side of the fire, both aiming rifles. Patchen pulled his head back behind the rock as two slugs blasted the side of it. He snaked his rifle around the rock and was about to draw a bead on the shooter when a rifle above and left fired. The man on the other side of the fire flew straight back into the darkness, throwing his Winchester.
Shit!
There was a crunch and a burst of sparks. Patchen's belly flip-flopped. He peered around the rocks and to the left and saw a man crawling out of the far fire, his back and arms aflame. The man pinwheeled, flapping his arms as though trying to fly, and sprinted off into the darkness, a human torch lighting up the surrounding bushes and trees. About 20 yards away, he collapsed against a boulder, clung there for a time, legs moving as though he were trying to climb the rock. Finally, the man slumped to the ground and lay there, flames leaping around him. Patchen spied movement on the far left side of the rocks. Spears came slowly out from cover, crouching over his rifle as he peered into the darkness around the fire. The shadow jounced in the tree ahead and to the left of Spears. Patchen tensed and brought his rifle up. At the same time, Spears swung his own rifle around, angling it up at the tree.
Hold on!
Firelight flashed off a brass rifle casing. A man dropped from the stout branch to the fork of the cottonwood and from there to the ground, landing flat-footed, bending his knees. Long black hair fell across his shoulders, and his sweat-stained buckskin shirt stretched taut across his chest. Yakima shuttled his gaze from the burning man to a spurred boot lying at the edge of the firelight to the dead man behind the fire nearest Patchen.
Damn, they only sent three. I was hoping for a few more.
God damn it, you used us for bait, you son of a bitch!
Yakima shook his head, peering cautiously into the darkness.
I just set a couple fires.
You're a crazy son of a bitch, Henry. How'd you know they wouldn't all come?
Yakima shrugged.
I wouldn't send my whole gang to check out three campfires, especially if I had gold to keep track of.
Yakima regarded the two lawmen with vague distaste.
And if you two are gonna hang around, you might as well make yourselves useful. I've got a hidden camp up yonder in the hills. Fetch your horses.
He turned and started away.
You got a lot of damn nerve.
It's gonna take a lot of nerve to take down the Thunder Riders.
Patchen rested his rifle barrel on his shoulder.
How do you propose to do it?
Yakima turned and stared at him. A faint smile touched the hard, shadowed planes of his face.
The Apache way. The Cheyenne way.
He turned and disappeared in the darkness. Flanked by the rest of the gang, Considine and McKenna stood before the ancient Indian ruins at the edge of the steaming River of No Return. They stared toward the three campfires on the dark hillock north of the canyon, watching the sudden fourth blaze spring up, move around, and die as gradually as the echoes of the gut-wrenching howl that accompanied it.
What the hell is that?
Don't know.
Whatever it is, it's dying.
McKenna turned to Considine.
Sounded like Pruitt.
Considine, who had sent Pruitt, McDonald, and a northern gunslick named Belknap to investigate the three fires, which had appeared suddenly on the hillock a mile or so away, said nothing as he stared through the snaking steam of the river, thumbs hooked in his pistol belt. Apprehension trickled a single bead of sweat down the middle of his back. He glanced at McKenna.
If the boys don't come back, take a couple of the others out at first light.
He turned and walked back toward the gang's own campfires, flaming here and there around the ruins, toward his bedroll and Anjanette. Ben Towers stepped up beside McKenna, who continued staring at the distant fires.
What'd he say, boss?
He said that if them three don't show by sunup, he wants you to take Hayes, Yossi, and Julie up to investigate.
With that, Mad Dog clapped Towers on the shoulder and followed Considine's path toward the gang's campfires. Just after sunup the next morning, Yakima, Patchen, and Spears lay belly down atop a low tabletop mesa, staring through rocks and brush toward the hillock where Yakima had set the three fires and killed the three Thunder Riders. Yakima checked the hillock with his spyglass and saw four other desperados now gathered there. Three of them kicked around the brush, while one, a tall black man in a low-crowned brown sombrero and a deerskin jacket, knelt over one of the dead men. The black man held a Spencer rifle in one hand and looked around with the quick, cautious movements of one accustomed to tracking and being tracked.
Well, they sent one more than last night.
Yakima passed the spyglass to Patchen, who raised it to his bruised, sunburned face, adjusting the focus. Spears lowered the glass and stared with his naked eyes across the rolling chaparral.
They picked up our tracks heading this way. Just three. Fourth seems to be heading back to the camp at the river. To report to Considine and Mad Dog, no doubt.
Yakima reached over Patchen and grabbed the spyglass from Spears.
Remember the plan. Spread out and give them plenty of sign, but not so much they sniff the trap.
He looped the spyglass's lanyard around his neck and began crabbing straight back along the mesa. When he was behind the mesa's brow, he rose and hoofed it back down the opposite slope. Their three horses waited at the mesa's base, tied to scrawny willows. Patchen and Spears followed. Yakima leapt atop the buckskin and turned toward the other two men, reaching for their saddle horns.
We meet back here. Don't get lost. It's a big desert.
He heeled the buckskin southwest, cutting through a sharp draw between mesas. Behind him, Spears turned to Patchen.
He's got one hell of a mouth for a half-breed.
You tell him that, Sheriff.
The marshal turned his own mount north and galloped off around the base of a low pinyon-studded mesa. An hour later, Spears hunkered among boulders spilling down the right shoulder of a rocky scarp, sheathed in creosote and gnarled elms. He stared down the other side of the hill into a tangle of low pines and barrel cactus growing around another split outcrop of black volcanic rock. He'd heard something from the split scarp ahead. Since then, Spears cheeked up to the rifle stock, breathing shallowly through slightly parted lips, staring at the scarp, his heart thudding rhythmically in his chest. The sheriff increased the tension on the rifle's trigger. A bobbing horse head appeared, a blaze-faced dun with a Mexican-style bridle, braided and inset with hammered silver discs. As the dun moved out from the narrow notch in the scarp, the black man in the saddle swung his head around slowly, his back taut but still moving fluidly with the horse's choppy steps. Spears continued easing back on the trigger until horse and rider slid suddenly behind the hill's brow, heading toward Spears' left.
Shit.
Spears pulled his head and rifle back behind the scarp and scrambled as quietly as he could to the other side of the rock. He crawled atop the hill's shoulder, left of the projecting rock, and aimed down the slope. The black man and the dun appeared, rising up out of the hill as though from the earth itself. The rider turned his head away from Spears. The sheriff's heart pounded as he held his breath and settled the rifle's foresight into the notch above the receiver, bearing down on the side of the black man's head. The man whipped around so suddenly that Spears didn't realize what had happened until his hat had been blown off his head. He stared, mouth agape, at the black man's smoking Spencer. The Spencer's stock was snug to the man's right cheek, and he was twisted slightly in the saddle, aiming the rifle at Spears. The bullet slammed into the desperado's upper left arm, splitting the coat seam and throwing the man sideways. The desperado tumbled down the right stirrup, jerking the horse's reins and twisting the horse's head so sharply that the horse fell hard on its right side, as though its hooves had been cut out from under it. The dun thrashed and shook its head and scissored its hooves as it climbed up off the desperado and galloped away, buck-kicking and trailing its reins. Behind the horse, the desperado writhed about in the dirt and gravel, rolling over several times, clutching both hands to his arm. His rifle and smashed hat lay several feet away. Spears ejected the spent shell and rose slowly. The black man lay at the base of the slope, on his back, wagging his head from side to side. Spears leveled the rifle on him and scrambled down the hill, keeping his eyes on the still dark form in the brush. Where the man and horse had fallen, the dust and brush were flattened and blood-flecked. Blood followed the man's trail several yards down the slope to where he now lay, belly rising and falling sharply, round eyes staring skyward, blood frothing from his nose and lips and down his chin, forming a red bib on his chest. The desperado's eyes rolled toward Spears, the pupils expanding and contracting slowly. Staring down, the sheriff grinned.
Sure wish I had time to cut your head off and haul it back to Tucson for the bounty, Towers. That kind of money a man wouldn't have to work a real job for months.
The man's eyes were flat and glassy, but his right hand moved feebly over the grips of the old model Colt riding high on his hip. Spears leaned down, grabbed the gun out from under the limp hand, and tossed it down the slope. The black man's mouth opened and closed several times, blood continuing to spill over his lips.
Finish me.
Grinning, Spears shook his head.
I'm gonna need all the lead I got for the rest of your gang.
He turned, climbed the slope, and stooped to pick up his hat. Frowning, he poked two fingers through the hole in the crown and glared down at the dying desperado.
Damn your hide, Towers. That was my best hat.
Big, blonde-headed Latigo Hayes reined his clay bank to an abrupt halt and canted his head, listening to the rifle report. Hayes sat the stout clay bank tensely, his heavy jaw hard under its thin coat of curly blonde whiskers and dust, wondering who'd gone down, one of his men or one of theirs, whoever theirs were. When the second echo had faded, the big desperado glanced down at the hoof prints he'd been following. They'd been leading him into the high, pine-studded hills east of the Canyon of Lost Souls. Lifting his eyes from the fresh tracks, he looked around warily, his thumb on the off-cocked hammer of his rifle. Seeing nothing but heavy brush and occasional pines and cacti, but needled by the feeling that a rifle barrel was aimed squarely on the back of his neck, he touched his spurs to the claybank's ribs. He followed the tracks into a narrow canyon, muddied by a run-out spring. Watching the tracks carefully, but also keeping an eye skinned on the rocks and brush around him, he followed the tracks out of the canyon and into another, where a small stone shrine nestled between two pines, the faceless figure of the Virgin Mary swathed in tree roots. A spray of wildflowers lay atop the shrine, brown and brittle as the dead leaves and pine needles around them. The man Hayes had been following had stopped here. His shod hoof prints were set deep in the clay. Looking around again and turning up the collar of his blanket coat, the air was cool, though the sun was bright. Hayes gigged his horse up canyon. He followed the canyon into a wide valley, then into another canyon, and through a gorge, taking a circuitous route that led nowhere. The big man's chest tightened and his hands grew slick inside his gloves. Tracing yet another narrow canyon, he drew back on the clay's reins once more and found himself staring down at the same shrine he'd stopped at a half hour ago.
What the?
As his own horse answered the whinny, he shot a sharp glance up the ridge and into the pines rising beside him, the sun peeking through the columnar shadows. Hayes' bowels churned with fear and fury. He looked around wildly.
Where are you, you son of a bitch?
Here.
Hayes jerked his horse sideways. Squatting atop the low canyon wall was a man with a high crown Stetson, silver mutton chop whiskers and mustache, and a copper star pinned to his buckskin mackinaw. The lawman grinned down the barrel of the Henry rifle aimed at Hayes' chest.
You ain't Considine, but this is for my peg just the same.
Smoke and flame stabbed from the Henry's barrel, obscuring the toothy smile of the face at the other end. Yakima knew the Apache was on his trail because the Apache pony he himself was riding continued to sniff the breeze and snort as though it smelled a familiar scent. Having an Apache on your trail, especially one as infamous as Kills Gold Hairs, was like having a rogue grizzly on your heels. Yakima could move quietly enough, see or hear clearly enough, and every brush rustle or falling pine cone sent ice through his veins. He'd been leading the Apache steadily up and over several relieved ridges for nearly an hour before he found a low saddle with sheltering rocks from which to effect an ambush. He tethered the buckskin on the saddle's backside, well hidden among pines, willows, and rock outcrops, then made his way back to the saddle and hunkered down in a notch on its rocky spine. Holding his Winchester up high across his chest, he leaned against a rock and stared down the saddle through sage, scattered pines, and occasional berry shrubs. Minutes passed like hours. Clouds shepherded shadows across the slope, and the distant blue ridges darkened as the sun angled west. Yakima had just begun to wonder if the Indian knew where he was and was going to wait for him to poke his head out of the rocks. Nobody could wait like an Apache. The yammering lifted the hair along Yakima's spine. He had heard young coyotes strayed from their pack kick up such a ruckus, but his gut told him this was no coyote.
Nice try.
Kills Gold Hairs knew Yakima was here, somewhere among these rocks, and was trying to lure him out to pink him from cover. Yakima pressed his right cheek against the stone wall. He edged a look down the slope with his left eye, careful not to angle any shadows on the ground before the notch. Another long minute passed. Down the slope, a horseback rider appeared, the man's long black hair buffeting in the wind. Astride a white-speckled dun, Kills Gold Hairs moved up the hill toward the saddle, clad in denims and knee-high moccasins, red and black calico shirt with a beaded medallion hanging around his neck, and a floppy-brimmed brown hat. Two revolvers hung in shoulder holsters. Two knives were snugged up tight against the man's hips, and he carried a Winchester carbine with a leather lanyard across his saddle bow. The Apache moved easily in his saddle with almost insulting ease, a faint smirk on his face, eyes slitted. He zigzagged the horse through the scattered pines and shrubs, batting its flanks with his moccasined heels. Suddenly, about 50 yards shy of the saddle, the Indian stopped the horse. He threw his head back on his shoulders and squeezed his eyes closed, opening and closing his mouth until the coyote-like yammering rose up the ridge to Yakima's ears. The bizarre cry made Yakima's scalp tingle. He eased down his Henry's barrel, snugged his cheek to the stock, and rested a bead on the Apache's calico shirt. Just as he was taking up the slack in his trigger finger, the Apache threw himself out of the saddle, hitting the ground on his shoulder and rolling. Yakima jerked the Henry's trigger back. Dust puffed up from a bleached log. The Indian bounded to his feet and ran through the trees and shrubs to Yakima's left. He dove over a low rise as Yakima fired another round. The slug plunked into the short grass, a foot off the Apache's left moccasin. And then the Indian was out of sight behind the brow of the hill, dust from the second strike scattering on the breeze. The riderless horse galloped back the way it had come, trailing its reins.
Son of a bitch.
Yakima bounded straight out of the notch, taking the Winchester in one hand. He wheeled and climbed the rocks above the notch, quickly gaining the top of the scarp. He squatted, extending the rifle in the direction the Apache had disappeared. He caught a glimpse of movement and snapped off a shot. Knowing the Apache would try to get around behind him, he bounded down the backside of the scarp and sprinted down the hill. Gaining the crease between hills at the bottom, he turned north, climbed another steep ridge through scattered pines and shrubs, and snugged up to a boulder at the top. Slowly, Yakima scaled the rock and edged a look down the other side. Directly beneath him, the Apache clung to the rock in mid-climb, his Winchester hanging by the lanyard down his back. His lips were stretched back from his teeth, and his brown eyes bored into Yakima's. He was so close that Yakima could see the pores in his sweat-slick skin, the distended cords and veins in his neck, and the missing eye tooth revealed by his stretched lips. Yakima rose from a crouch and lowered his Winchester's barrel. At the same time, the Indian whipped his hand up toward the top of the rock. Yakima's left boot was jerked out from beneath him, and the ground bounded up suddenly to slam against his back. His finger jerked back on the rifle's trigger, the slug sailing skyward. Before Yakima knew what had happened, the Indian was on top of him, slashing down with a stout-bladed Bowie. Yakima threw his left hand up, caught the Indian's right wrist, stopping the blade inches from his throat. He bucked straight up. The Indian flew, twisting and turning in midair, across the boulder and out of sight. Yakima winced at the pain at the back of his head, then lurched to his feet and glanced down the far side of the rock. At its crenellated base, the Indian lay impaled, belly up, on a sharp branch sticking straight up from a deadfall pine. The man's arms and legs sagged toward the ground. The eyelids opened and closed several times before freezing, half-closed. One foot jerked and fell still. Blood bubbled up and around the forked branch protruding from the Apache's torn shirt and belly. Yakima sleeved sweat from his forehead and turned to retrieve his hat and Winchester, then began descending the rock. The killing had just begun. Considine's arm shot out from under Anjanette's head. He reached across his own body, grabbed one of the revolvers from his matched holsters, and thumbing back the hammer, aimed the barrel straight out at the fire, guttering in the stone ring near his and Anjanette's blanketed feet. Sparks rose from a short, ash-white log, along the edge of which a slender orange flame flickered. Propped on one arm, Anjanette slid her gaze from the fire to Considine, staring wildly at the flames, his index finger drawn taut against the trigger.
Just the fire.
She reached out to push the gun down.
Shit.
Considine depressed the hammer, then slid the revolver into the holster beside him. He fell back against his saddle and drew his blankets to his chin. Anjanette lay back against her own saddle for a time, staring at the luminous sky. It was close to dawn. Behind her, she could hear the gurgle of the river and feel its warmth penetrating the chill night air. She closed her eyes and drew the blanket up to her chin, but she could tell that sleep wouldn't return.
Damn Considine and his nerves. Always so eager to take a shot at something or someone.
She threw her blankets back and rose to her knees. Considine turned to her sharply, frowning.
Where you going?
For a swim.
He stared at her, his brows ridged.
Is that all right? Should I have asked permission first?
The desperado leader rested his head back against the saddle.
No, that's all right, I reckon.
He lowered his hat over his eyes and crossed his arms on his chest.
There's woolly hombres out there. Stay close. Take a pistol.
As Considine's chest began rising and falling rhythmically, Anjanette stood, wrapped a blanket around her shoulders, pulled her boots on, and headed off through the ruins toward the river, sliding through the fog at the bottom of the canyon. She stepped around a couple of sleeping gang members. Knowing that three were posted around the ruins and on the ridge overlooking the canyon, she aimed for a thick stand of cottonwoods lining the river, out of sight from above. On the shore, screened from the ridge by the stout trees, she kicked out of her boots, shucked out of her skirt, shirt, and underclothes. She shivered, feeling a dank chill in the warm fog. Cupping her breasts in her hands, she stepped into the river. The water felt like ink rising over her knees and hips as she waded toward a pool in a slight horseshoe a few yards downstream. In the pool, she sank down, enjoying the sensation of the warm liquid closing over her. For a time, she lolled there, thinking about Considine. She regretted getting mixed up with the desperado leader. She saw now that he had two faces. Before throwing in with the gang, she'd been shown only the face of the sweet, roving rogue. He was much coarser, darker, and angrier than she'd expected. Anjanette was no hothouse flower, but Considine's predilection for violent lovemaking left her feeling cheap and frightened. She'd seen what he'd done to Yakima's horse. Any man who could pistol-whip a defenseless animal was no man to keep company with. But then, if she went back to Saber Creek, old Antoine would only continue to work her like a rented mule. In 5 years, she would look like one of those Indian War widows who tended chickens and took in laundry in their brush huts along the creek. Anjanette cupped the lukewarm water over her breasts, lolling back in the stream.
Yakima.
There was a man who knew how to treat a woman. His touch had been neither too gentle nor too harsh. There was a man who, born and bred in the wild, owned a strange sensitivity. While reveling in his own manliness, Yakima could treat a woman to the sweet sublime. Even now, she could feel his big hands, his lips, the sweep of his long hair on her breasts, his hips thrusting between her thighs, his muscular buttocks flexing beneath her hands. The problem with the handsome half-breed was that he was as untamed as his horse. Lonely, to be sure, but a loner just the same. She wondered where he was now. He'd no doubt searched for his horse, because Yakima and the Black Mustang were like blood brothers. Maybe he'd given up by now, realizing that no one man could tangle with the Thunder Riders. He'd probably bought another horse in Saber Creek and returned to his mountain cabin alone. A hand closed over Anjanette's shoulder. She jerked her head around with a start. Behind her, in the snaking mist, staring down at her stonily, Toots loomed, silhouetted in the weak dawn light. Naked, the big woman looked like a pale pumpkin with breasts resembling half-filled gut flasks. Her round belly bulged out beneath them. She had pulled her hair back in a bun, a few strands wisping around her plump cheeks and expressionless eyes. Anjanette crossed her arms over her breasts and closed her legs.
Jesus, you scared the hell out of me.
Toots held out her hand. Anjanette half expected to see a stiletto in it. Toots slid the grimy sliver of lye soap toward her.
Wash my back.
Anjanette stared at her, the water flowing around her waist and Toots's chubby, dimpled knees. Toots jerked her hand, frowning impatiently.
You wash my back, and I wash yours.
Anjanette glanced at the soap, then at the woman's eyes, still half expecting a trick of some kind. Seeing no cunning in Toots's expression, Anjanette lowered her arms and climbed to her feet. Toots's gaze slid across Anjanette's breasts, her expression softening. Anjanette took the soap from the woman's hand.
If you want your back scrubbed, turn around.
Toots turned. Anjanette crouched to dampen the soap, then rubbed it between her hands until she'd worked up a good lather. She applied the lather to Toots's back, inwardly recoiling at the feel of the woman's soft flesh under her palms, the bowed shoulders, a wedge of flaccid breast peeking out from under her right arm.
That feels good.
When Anjanette had finished lathering the woman's back, she held the soap over Toots's right shoulder.
Here.
Toots sank down into the water and plucked the soap out of Anjanette's hand. Again, her eyes strayed across Anjanette's full breasts.
I'll wash you.
No, thanks.
Toots frowned.
I wash you.
Anjanette held the woman's gaze. Was Toots, in her own awkward way, trying to bury the hatchet? Anjanette shrugged and turned around.
Bend down.
Huh?
You're taller than me. Bend down a little.
Anjanette bent forward. Toots began running her soap-lathered hands across Anjanette's back. She was a little chagrined at the pleasant sensation of the soft, soapy hands on her skin. Toots stopped scrubbing, touched her finger to a slight bruise just beneath Anjanette's right shoulder blade.
That hurt?
Anjanette didn't answer. Toots continued scrubbing, rubbing both palms up and down and across Anjanette's slender back.
Jack getting raw?
Nothing I can't handle.
Toots ran her right hand down under Anjanette's arm, sliding her fingers across the side of Anjanette's round, firm breast.
One thing you can expect out of Jack. He'll get rougher.
Anjanette clamped her arm taut against her side.
I can get pretty rough myself.
Toots slid her hand down Anjanette's other side and snaked it forward to cup that breast, palming the nipple.
Me, though, I can be slow. Easy life.
Anjanette thrust Toots' hand away and turned, crossing her arms on her chest, an angry flush rising in her cheeks.
I don't care how slow and easy you are. Keep your hands off my tits and don't come near me again.
There was no warning signal in Toots' eyes before she slammed the back of her right hand against Anjanette's jaw. A stinging blow of fire ripping through Anjanette's lower lip. As Anjanette's head flew back, Toots leapt toward her, wrapping her hands around her neck. Anjanette tripped on the slippery rocks and fell on her back in the water. Toots fell on top of her, driving Anjanette's head under the water as her fingers pressed into her neck, pinching off her wind. Anjanette thrashed, panicking as the back of her head was ground against the rocks and the water washed over her face. She looked up through her own bursting air bubbles to see Toots' face pinched with fury just above the surface, teeth gritted. She ground her knees into Anjanette's chest and ribs and dug her fingertips into her throat as though trying to claw out her windpipe. Anjanette flailed with clawed hands, but Toots, grinning maniacally, tipped her head back out of reach. Feeling as though her lungs were about to explode, Anjanette raised her right leg and pushed off the river bottom with every ounce of her remaining strength. Toots flew to the side. At the same time, Anjanette bounded up, water flying off her body, her nose burning. She'd barely gotten up when Toots was on her again, rising up out of the river and throwing her head into Anjanette's belly. Again they went down, but this time Anjanette twisted, punching her right fist against Toots's cheek so hard that Anjanette's own knuckles barked painfully. The big woman tumbled sideways. As she lifted her head once more, Anjanette staggered toward her across the rocks, water splashing up around her legs, and jabbed her again with her other fist. Toots's head flew back, and one arm dropped in the water. When she turned toward Anjanette again, the left side of her bottom lip hung down like a bloody leech. Fire flashed in Toots's eyes. She leapt toward Anjanette. They went down together, rolling and struggling. Anjanette glimpsed the rest of the gang, which had dwindled to only 7 or 8 men gathered along the shore in various states of dress. A couple of them, including Toots' brother Tomas, were shaking hands as though a bet had been placed. Considine stood before a willow snag in only his long underwear, boots, and cartridge belt, fists on his hips, grinning bemusedly around a cold cigar.
Shit!
Made lucid by fury, Anjanette ducked a haymaker, then brought her right fist up hard into Toots' plump belly. Toots dropped to her knees, then lurched forward and pulled Anjanette's feet out from under her. Anjanette hit the rocks hard. Knowing how fast Toots could move in spite of her size, Anjanette quickly regained her knees, but somehow Toots had wrapped her arms around the back of Anjanette's neck. Snaking her hand under Toots' arms, Anjanette dropped her head and slung the big woman over her right shoulder and tossed her into the river. Sucking air down her battered windpipe, Anjanette scrambled to her feet. Toots pushed onto her hands and knees, hanging her head with exhaustion, bleeding from the half-dozen cuts and scrapes on her face, arms, and knuckles. Anjanette staggered before her, grabbed her under her arms, and hoisted her up. Toots's dark, dazed eyes met Anjanette's.
If you know what's good for you...
Anjanette headbutted the big woman so hard that Toots's eyes rolled back in her head, and she went limp in Anjanette's arms.
You stay the hell away from me, bitch!
Anjanette dropped her arms. Toots fell into the river, lolled on her back, arms and legs spreading out around her in the current. Covering her breasts with her arms, already feeling one of her eyes swell and licking blood from her split lips, Anjanette headed for shore.
Shit! Pay up, Tomas!
The men standing on the bank were exchanging money. Considine held her blanket out while Mad Dog stood beside him, grinning and squinting through puffs of cigarette smoke.
I'm impressed, Chiquita. Not many men, let alone women, have ever beaten Toots in a fair fight.
Anjanette grabbed the blanket out of his hands and wrapped it around herself and under her arms, folding it closed. She stooped to gather her clothes and stalked off through the trees.
McKenna, I believe you owe me $20.
I'm sad to lose $20, but damn, that was a good show.
Nothing better than watching two naked women fighting.
Hey, boss, look there!
Considine turned. Tuts's brother, Tomas, was out in the river helping his sister to shore. He'd stopped several yards from the bank and, holding the big woman with one arm, pointed toward the opposite side of the river. Three horses stood at the edge of the water, staring toward Considine. The other men had begun dispersing and heading back to their morning coffee fires before Tomas had yelled. Considine stared at the horses. At first, he didn't think they were carrying riders, but he saw now that he was wrong. They were carrying riders, all right. The riders were sitting backward on the saddles, and they were lying belly down across their cantles. Considine threw his cheroot into the river. He glanced at Mad Dog, then moved into the river, heedless of the water rising over his boots, climbing past his knees and thighs. He took long strides against the stream, swinging his arms, frowning at the three horses, watching him warily, twitching their ears and flicking their tails. Considine approached the opposite shore. Mad Dog and the other men spread out to his left and slightly behind, all except Tomas, who stood with Toots on the opposite shore, staring across the sliding, fog-shrouded stream at the horses, two duns and a clay bank. Considine stopped several feet in front of the clay belonging to Latigo Hayes and ran his gaze across the horse's saddle. His beard bristled and his face warmed. Latigo Hayes sat the saddle backward, leaning forward so that his face was pressed against the horse's spotted ass. Latigo's hands and ankles were tied under the horse's belly. His face was turned toward Considine, tongue protruding slightly, sightless eyes half open and staring at something downstream. He wore no hat, and his blonde hair was ruffled by the morning breeze. Considine moved around behind the clay. The other men were moving up around the front of the horses, water sluicing off their underwear bottoms or denims, frowning as they cast their gazes across the three horses' grisly cargoes. Yazzie and the black outlaw Ben Towers both sat their own saddles the way Latigo sat his, backward and dead. Considine looked at Mad Dog, staring at him over the ass of Towers' dun gelding. He didn't say anything, but his half-grizzled face looked even more grizzled than usual, the mottled skin drawn tighter across the bone, the right eye narrowed to a slit.
Bandidos!
That'd be my guess. They seen us carrying the gold, trailed us here. They're trying to pick us off a little at a time until there's nothing left but the gold.
I reckon it's time we all mounted up and got after them.
Considine turned and stared up the low hills rising away from the river toward the surrounding Blue Mountains, growing more and more distinct as the sun rose. He shook his head.
That's what they want, so they can run us to a frazzle and bushwhack us somewhere off in them mountains.
He shuttled his gaze this way and that. Anger was burning in him. Anger and the emotion he enjoyed least, fear. Someone was toying with him, playing a nettling little game of cat and mouse. The stalker hadn't yet gotten the gold, but the fact that he, or they, had wiped out nearly half his gang so quickly and cunningly meant that they were winning. Eventually, they'd get the gold. The idea of Considine being whipped like this by an unknown enemy was enough to blow the top of his head off.
We'll stay right here. Let them come to us.
Mad Dog glanced at the others standing around the horses before following Considine's gaze toward the mountains.
I reckon that's best, though I sure would like to run those Jaspers down. Teach them you don't mess with the Thunder Riders.
Considine looked around, counting the men they had left. Including Tomas, on the other side of the stream, there were seven. Considine's eyes darted up toward the ruined mud shacks climbing the canyon's southern wall.
Hey! Who's supposed to be guarding the gold?
The other six men glanced at each other. Finally, the half-breed Sioux, Quint Brokenbow, turned to Julie Clubfoot Hale.
I reckon I was.
Hale ran a gloved hand through his shaggy beard.
I just come down to see what all the commotion in the river was about.
Mad Dog's cheek dimpled.
You mean that gold is sitting up there in them ruins, unprotected?
Hale backed away toward the river, shuttling his sheepish gaze between Considine and Mad Dog, hemming and hawing and wringing his hands.
Haul ass, fool!
Hale jumped with a start and stumbled into the river, heading for the other shore. Considine turned to Quint.
Go with him, Quint!
From now on, I want two men guarding the strongbox at all times!
He looked again at the three dead men and made a sour expression. His eyes narrowed.
I can't wait to meet the smart sons of bitches who've done this. I just can't wait.
Yakima woke at midnight. He lifted his head from his saddle, threw his blankets back, reached over in the cold darkness and jerked Patchen's left boot. The marshal snapped his head up, a hand dropping to the holster on his hip.
It's time to move.
Patchen froze, glanced at Yakima, then turned and nudged Spears, lying a few feet away. The sheriff looked around wildly until he realized he wasn't about to have his throat cut by the Thunder Riders. It was dark as tar in the hollow where they'd gold camped, and Yakima began rolling up his blankets and gathering his gear, mostly by feel. The lawmen followed suit, and in a few minutes, all three horses were rigged and ready. The men swung into their saddles, the creaking of the leather sounding dangerously loud in the quiet, frosty night. Low clouds sharpened the slightest sound, but the absence of moon and stars would make Yakima's job in the canyon easier. He and the lawmen rode southwest. Because of the darkness, they had to hold their horses to a trot. An hour after they'd left the camp, the giant stone walls of an ancient Spanish cathedral rose on a low mesa before them, glowing as though from a faint light within the crumbling vine-shrouded stone. At the cathedral's east end, Spears and Patchen checked their horses down among the rubble of the collapsed ceiling and the giant cracked pillars. Yakima merely slowed the buckskin as he continued southwest.
I'll try to lead them this way. Stay alert.
He batted his heels against the mount's ribs, continuing on across the sloping mesa. Spears leaned forward on his saddle horn.
Oh, here he goes again.
Patchen swung down from his saddle.
You can take that up with him after we've got the gold. After we've kicked the rest of the gang out with a cold shovel.
Spears dug in his shirt pocket for his making sack.
Shit. That crazy half-breed can sneak into that canyon, find the gold and the girl, and lead that crew into our rifle sights. I might just give him my badge.
Patchen led his horse off.
What makes you think he'd want it?